Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, Mr. Dave Martino.
Yes, I am here.
I just see it. I'm always testing. See if you're asleep, you know.
I'm awake.
No, I know you're doing something.
You just woke me up.
Yeah, I know what you're doing. sitting in the corner drinking whiskey, knitting.
That's right.
Something, you know, you fall asleep. You know? But it happens at your age, right? What's it going to be? You're going to be
53.
Wow. Won't Crazy. Be long. Arthritis yet?
A little bit, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Can't get up and down.
Yeah, it's tough, you know.
Yeah, you're gonna have to install an elevator in your place, you know, so you can.
Yeah, that's right.
I was gonna say.
What are those chairs that goes up the stairs?
Yeah, and make sure you get the one that works even when the power's out, because that's something you might need, right?
Yeah, I would hate to get stuck.
Yeah, so I'm stuck in the middle.
Terrible.
Can't get to the bathroom. Fall in it. I can't get out.
Yeah, I need one of those. Those little buttons that you press.
Oh, yeah. Actually, now I've got the idea. That's what I'll get you for your birthday.
Oh, perfect.
I'll sign you up. You know.
I'll be safe forever.
Well, you know, and I thought the clap-on, too, right? So you can get that for your lights.
That's true. I think they still make those. But see, now you can just talk to, you know, one of the, I don't want to say a wake word. And
yeah.
You know, but you can do it like an Echo Dot or something like that and turn the lights on.
So yeah, I guess
you don't clap anymore.
Yeah. Well, that's too
nostalgic,
bad.
Though.
Yeah. Kind of like it. Well, now speaking of nostalgic, we have got a writer here. Now, he's written a lot of books and mystery, crime, and all that. And let's just get him in and let's talk about what he's doing. So, Mr. Lawrence Kelser, welcome.
Hi, Alan. How are you?
I'm good. So it looks like you've been in the world of writing mystery and fiction and stuff like that. So how did that start for you? Like, where did you get the notion to go into doing this type of work?
Well, you know, I wanted to write for quite some time. I really got into it when I was in college. I had a really cool professor who was encouraging and, you know, he let me write funny stuff and he wouldn't punish me for it. And you know, he planted the seed, so to speak, but it was a very, you know, very long, I guess, gestation period, you might call it, because I didn't really pick up the typewriter until I was in my 40s. And I've been writing for about 20 years now.
So that's kind of a late start. Was there something that happened that made give you kind of the courage, I guess we would say, to actually get something published, get people to read it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the initial impetus was that I really was getting bored in my day job. I was working in the apparel industry, and, you know, it was a great thing for a long time, but year by year, I started to get more and more disenchanted with it. And, you know, I started by picking up a legal pad and a pencil and scribbling all kinds of stuff that I could never read afterwards. When they came out with the first portable word processor, I think it was a Smith Corona, and I think it was about as big as a pizza box.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
And I lived on Long Island. I worked in the city. And I would take this pizza box on the train with me every day and squeeze in, make everybody next to me uncomfortable. And I would write for an hour on the way into Manhattan and write for an hour on the way back to Long Island. And, you know, I was driven to do it. I just really wanted to do it. I didn't feel so much that, you know, I wanted people to read my work, but I felt I had a story or stories, and I wanted to start getting them down. And I developed a discipline. I wrote every day. I wrote through the weekends. I just really wanted to get that, you know, that first book, you know, on that little micro cassette that they gave you with it.
Okay, so now you've had a little bit of success in the sense of my Cousin Vinny. You've done the a three-part a sequel, right, or something. What went on there?
I'll take you back. I would say to 2017. I'm in my den. I've got the laptop up, and I'm watching TV at the same time, and I start flipping the channels. You know, you hear those famous words, you know, my biological clock is ticking, and my niece, 30 years old, is, you know, already expecting a third kid. And that's it. I'm hooked. As soon as I start hearing the dialect from the movie, I've got to watch it. Got to put everything else down. Interestingly enough, My Cousin Vinny is the most rewatched movie of all times. So I'm not the only sucker who, you know, can't get up from the couch when that comes on. So I'm watching the movie. I've seen it a dozen times, but I'm laughing just as hard as I did the first time I saw it in the theaters over 20 years ago. And when it was done, I said, you know, as a writer, I think the screenwriter would just love to get a little pat on the back. 20 years since the movie was released, I mean, I'm sure people aren't stopping him in the street and saying, hey, you did a good job. So I did a little research. I got his email address. I sent off a note. And I figured, you know what? I did my part. I'm not going to hear back from this guy. This is a screenwriter who not only wrote My Cousin Vinny, he also wrote Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, arguably two of the funniest movies of all time, at least in my opinion. And I said, you know, I'm a mid-list novelist. This guy's Hollywood. You know, I'm kind of dirt beneath his boot. I'm not going to hear back. But within 20 minutes, the guy wrote me back a tome. He wrote me back this, you know, detailed email telling me things about the movie I never thought to ask, and nobody would actually know, you know, who he originally wanted to play the role before Joe Pesci was cast. He wanted, believe it or not, his first choice for Vinny. He saw Vinny more as a like a Joe Pesci type, like a big punch drunk guy, intimidating. You know, he never really saw him as Joe Pesci, and he wanted Andrew Dice Clay to play the role. The studio said no. And then he said, okay, well, my second choice is Robert De Niro. And the studio said no. And this is a couple of years before Analyze This came out. And De Niro hadn't done any comedy up until that point. They said, no, De Niro's not funny. He's scary. We're not going to hire him. And then they finally got around to Joe Pesci. And, of course, you know, he was, you know, the perfect choice for it. He also told me some other interesting things. For example, the studio wanted to cut Marissa Tomei out of the movie halfway through. They called him in for a meeting, and they said, you know what? We don't think we need her. Why don't you take her best lines and give them to Vinny? And he said, no, you can't do that. She's, you know, she's crucial to the movie. You can't do that. And they said, well, then beef up her character or she's gone. And that's that scene that I was talking about before, where she's standing on the porch in her black cat suit and she's stomping her foot and talking about a biological clock. That was written halfway through the filming in order to ensure her part, because they were going to cut her out. You know, those are some of the things that came across, you know, initially. And emails, one email led to the next. Then we started talking on the phone. And, of course, you know, I asked the question he must have been asked 100 times, is how come there was no sequel? And he said, well, there was. I wrote a sequel. But the studio didn't like it, so they hired somebody to rewrite it, and they didn't like that either, so they dropped the project. And then they came back to him a couple of years later, and they said, let's make a TV show. And, you know, if we all think back to TV writing in the 90s, you know, we're not talking about the quality of stuff you can see on the streaming services today or on network today. And, you know, it was pretty schlocky. And he said, no, I'm not going to give Vinny and Lisa to a couple of schlock TV writers. And then they dropped that idea as well. He said, but you know, I've always wanted them to have more of a life. I always saw them as a modern day Nick and Nora, where Lisa does the investigation and then Joe takes him into court and does the litigation. And I said, well, you know, I'd love to write some of that. And he said, you know, I don't know. Most of today's humor is sort of like stoner humor or real sweet romantic comedy. I don't really dig that. And we ended the call, you know, and a couple of weeks later, he called me up and he said, you know, I read one of your books and you're pretty funny. You want to try it? And of course, I said, yes. I mean, I love the movie. I love the characters. And I have to say, writing that trilogy was the most fun I've ever had sitting behind a keyboard.
I guess it would be, you know. Do you kind of live through the characters then? Like, when you're, how is it when you're writing? So when you're sitting behind that keyboard and you're writing these characters, do you experience them in your head and mind? Does it run to you like a movie? And like, what's that situation like for you?
Yeah, I'm very visual, particularly with the My Cousin Vinny books. I could see them in my head. I could, you know, I took a context from the movie and then I would see them speaking my lines. You know, if they were in a restaurant, I pictured them in a restaurant from the movie, and then I tried to see them banging it out in my story. You know, they always had that romantic little cat and mouse game, that little one-upsmanship where they're, you know, trying to get over on each other, but not to be mean, more to, you know, more to play with each other. So I always had that in mind, that they would never, you know, they always, you know, had this wordplay. They were always dueling, but never to hurt one another, really, just to, you know, either have fun or to push a point.
Oh, did you have to get permission from the studio to do the My Cousin Vinny books, or did the screenwriter retain all the rights?
It was a combination of the two. Once we agreed that we wanted to do it, you know, I called my attorney, he called his attorney, then they called the studio, then five attorneys later, and they had an agreement. So, yeah, it was, you know, we made our contribution to the American legal system. But, yeah, I mean, the studio was pretty easygoing. You know, they wanted certain conditions, and they wanted the right to review, and they wanted to, you know, do basic things, but they were never really onerous, never really gave me a hard time. And the same was true with the screenwriter. His name is Dale Lorner. He's a great guy. He's about my age. Yeah, you know, once we agreed to do it and I kind of gave him outlines, he kind of gave me free rein to sculpt the book the way I wanted to. He's a creative guy. He had some ideas and he threw them at me, but most of the story, is pretty much out of my imagination.
Now let's talk about this book, Mankiller. Now you're saying it kind of, came from your writing with the My Cousin Vinny sequels, right?
Yes, that's correct. There's a character in the sequel who is who's a gal who's on trial for her life in the second book. She's Vinny's second court case victory. And her sister is the main character in Mankiller. And when I finished writing the trilogy, I said, you know, well, what next? You know, this was so much fun for me. I want to do more. So I came up with a very Lisa-like character, and her name is Gina Marie Cotati, and she's a Brooklyn PI, and she's sharp-witted and funny and feisty, and she comes from a very devout Sicilian family, and they meet for dinner every Sunday without fail. Nobody, you know, never a case where they don't show up for Sunday dinner. It's a tradition, and she's got good old values, and her dad is a retired police sergeant. And, you know, she's very, very into right and wrong, you know, and she's got a great, great moral compass.
Well, so what's it like writing a female lead character? Do you have any, how do you get around that?
Well, I kind of muddle through it, honestly. I've been writing female characters for a very long time. My first series and probably my most successful to date is based on a character called Stephanie Chalice. It's a 9-book series. And, you know, at the beginning it was a bit of a challenge, and I did get some negative feedback at the very beginning. People, you know, writing and saying, you know, this is not a real woman. This is the male embodiment of the female sexual fantasy. And they were right to some extent, but I eventually rewrote the first book and, you know, tamed it down a little bit. And as I wrote the second and the third, she became more of a real living, breathing woman, you know, as I would believe. And, I've got a lot of practice. I think if you're observant and you're a student of life, you know, you can write men, you can write women. You know, there are plenty of women out there writing male characters and plenty of men writing female characters. And it's like any other skill. You just have to work at it and practice at it, and hopefully eventually you do a good job at it.
Well, you mentioned the mandatory Sunday dinner, which is kind of an old Italian thing that I know it used to be done on my dad's side of the family. You had to be there for Sunday dinner. Do you have experience with that, or do you know if that's still a thing? I'm just curious.
Oh, it's still a thing. Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, you'll see it on social media. I mean, there are groups about, you know, Sicilian and proud of it, and Italian and proud of it, and war. I'm Sicilian and I'm living in New Jersey. There are all kinds of social media groups like that. But, you know, the crux of it is that my wife is Sicilian. I'm a, you know, a kid from Brooklyn from, a, you know, with a Jewish heritage. And for me, Italian food was, you know, spaghetti and George sauce. Or SpaghettiOs out of the can, or ravioli out of the can. And that was my experience with, you know, quote-unquote Italian or Sicilian food until I met my wife, and I was invited for Sunday dinner for the first time. And I got there mid-afternoon sometime, and I don't know, it got dark, and I was still sitting at the table, and they were bringing out seconds and leftovers, and I'm still sitting at the table. You know, fortunately at the time, I was a skinny, you know, skinny kid, and I could absorb the calories. But over a lifetime, they've taken their toll.
I understand. I'm Italian and Jewish, so I'm all confused.
Okay, yeah. So that's, you know, that was a thing. It's definitely still a thing. I couldn't say my wife does it every weekend. You know, I think we're a little bit more, I don't know, progressive than that. But, you know, when the holidays come around, she's, you know, raising meatballs and making bruschetta and making delicacies, you know, for specific holidays, like for Easter, as an example, she'll make something called a pizza rustica, which is a sort of a pie with ricotta and sausage and cheese. And it's, you know, just out of this world. It's a minimum of 8,000 calories a slice. and I mean, you know, it's definitely still a thing. And
you're making me hungry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is the basic idea behind the book? Because you're going to be writing, this is book one, so you've kind of got it in your mind that this is going to be a series. So do you have this kind of outline? Do you kind of have an idea of how many books you want to do with this main character and where you want to go?
No, I'm at that age where I can't think that far ahead. I know what I want to do for the second book, and I've started working on it. But I'll write them as long as they're fun to write and people enjoy them. You know, as with the Stephanie Challis series, that's 9 books long, and I haven't published one recently, but that's not to say that I wouldn't go back and build a series back up again if, you know, if I came up with some ideas I like to put across. You know, like I said, this is a fun book. It's not a War and Peace. I try to make it as realistic as possible. You know, she is a private eye. I really don't like it when, you know, you read things or you watch things on a screen where the police work they do absolutely makes no sense at all. So, you know, I have a lot of experience writing police procedurals, and, you know, I try to keep it as realistic as possible. I try to keep the plot very engrossing with a lot of twists and turns and some red herrings. I try to make it as good a thriller or a mystery as I can, but with interjecting a lot of humor.
Well, yeah, you know, it keeps it moving. And I guess you got to be selective of where and when you do the humor.
You do. It has to be appropriate. And, you know, that's, you know, a tough job for me, you know, going back, editing, where I say to myself, you know, this is just over the top, or, you know, how many jokes can you throw in on a page? And then you've got to cut them out. But, you know, the issue is not cutting them out. The issue is, you know, not coming up with good ideas. So if you think you've got a lot of great material, you're way ahead of the game. You can, you know, write a big draft and come back and put the scalpel to it and take out what's unnecessary.
Well, with humor itself, comedy, you know, there seems tends to need to be like a timing, I guess, for like stand-up comedians. Do you think there's a timing for humor in prose fiction? Is that how you make something kind of work?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there was a did you watch the show The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel?
I did not.
You did not. Okay, well, you know, she was a stand-up comedian, and it was based loosely, I believe, on the life of Joan Rivers. And there's a segment in one of the episodes where she's fine-tuning a joke. And you can see over the span of, you know, 60 or 90 seconds how she took the raw joke and changed it and changed it and changed it. And when she finally came up with, you know, the way she really wanted the joke, it had so much more impact than when she first conceived it. And I think it's the same thing with writing. The joke has to be appropriate. you know, you don't want the joke to come out of left field where you're in a very tense situation and, you know, somebody farts or something like that. I mean, you know, it doesn't work. So you try to make it appropriate to the scene, appropriate to the setting. Sometimes you want to use it to relieve tension, which I think is a good thing to do when you've got, you know, the reader so wound up that you don't, you know, he's not going to know where to go next. You know, sometimes the levity will fix things in that situation. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, humor has its place, but it shouldn't be every place. And I have, you know, critiquers who read the books before I finish them up. My wife is my first editor-in-chief, and I belong to a small critique group, and they read all my stuff, and, you know, they slap me on the wrist when I'm getting, you know, I get out of control.
Yeah, I know all about that. So at the end of the day, do you have a subtext or a meaning, or is there something underlying the entertainment in the story?
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I mean, it might come up organically or it might be planned, but what is it you want the reader to get out of the book? Is it pure entertainment?
I would say it's mostly entertainment. You know, it's entertainment. Let's call a spade a spade. A spade a spade. I want the reader to sit down, you know, whether it's for 2 or 3 days or 4 nights or whatever it takes them to read the book. And hopefully, you know, it's, you know, they're going to breeze right through it. I'm not trying to be hoady in my books or put in, you know, words that the reader's going to have to go to the dictionary to figure out. I want them to breeze through it. I want them to be glued to the page. I want them to keep turning pages. And, you know, when they get to the end, I want them to say, yeah, that was a great experience. I had a lot of fun reading that book. You know, I think there's a lot of good police procedural writers, a lot of good crime writers out there. I like to think I'm pretty good. But possibly what separates me from many of them is, you know, is my sense of humor.
Are you conscious about the violence and how you write it in the book?
Yeah, I'm not a gory writer or an erotic writer. You won't find, unfortunately for some, you won't find sex on the page. It's a lot of build up and aftermath type of thing. The sex happens, you know, off the page. And the same thing with the violence. You know, there'll be an attack. But I won't go to great lengths to describe how gory and how horrible the body looks, or, you know, they may do a horrible thing, but I'll try to present it in a palatable way. I mean, I've read books where they find the body and it's been stabbed and it's been shot and it's been, you know, it's been slashed and hung, and it's like, come on already, you know, just kill the victim. You know, not every murder is a torture. Not every murderer is a psychopath. You know, I think, you know, at some point all that, you know, gets unbelievable and turns off the reader. You know, do you really want the reader to say, oh my God, that's disgusting? You know, they stop reading. I got to go get a cup of coffee. I can't get my mind around this one. That's not what I do.
Right. Cause not every murderer cooks and eats their meat.
No, Hannibal, they don't.
No. I mean, you know, there's days that they don't feel like it. I'm just saying. Right? I'm just, I don't know. Well, that's crazy. So now when you're writing this, so did you come up in this particular case, like for instance here, did you come up with your character first and then you decide where you're going to put her and what's going to happen and build the story around her? Or did you have a story and then you put her into the story?
I always have the character first. The character may need some fine tuning and some modification as I go along, but I've got a basic construct of what I want the character to be like. You know, the story, there are a lot of very good writers who have to plan the whole thing out from page one till the very end. You know, Jeffrey Deaver, as an example, is a guy who'll take months and months to plot his book and fill his office with sticky notes, and, you know, and then once he figures he's got to plot it all the way through, he'll go in and fill it in. I don't work that way. I won't say I'm completely organic. I mean, there are times where I have to go and make a list of things I need to accomplish between where I am and the end of the book. But I like the story to unfold before me. I feel like I want to be surprised. And if I'm not surprised, how can the reader be surprised? Not everything can be scripted, if you know what I mean. Yeah.
Well, in your series books, how do you keep track of continuity? Do you have a series Bible? Do you have tools or a system to keep track of everything?
No, I just have a failing memory. And, you know, I really should be a little bit tougher on myself and maybe do that and make a compendium of what this character has done. But I find myself, you know, going back to previous books and rereading them or flipping through them to check out a point before I move forward. Yeah, that's one of my failings. I think some people are probably better about it than I am. In fact, I'm sure there are. But, you know, it's worked out pretty well so far. And, you know, you're always advancing the character. There's always a character arc and a series arc where the character's changing a little bit between the first page and the last page, or their life is changing over a course of several books. And, you know, as long as you're moving them along, you know, I don't find it that difficult. I don't think I make too many mistakes. I haven't had people write in and say, hey, you know, you made her a lefty in book three and now she's a righty. That hasn't happened to me so far. So I guess I still have enough brain cells to keep it going.
I always wonder this. So you've got this other series that you've written, and you said you had 9 books of another mystery. What's the difference in the 2 books? How is this one different than your first series?
In the first series, which is also a female detective, she's, I would say, you know, a bit more professional. She's a police detective in New York City. In order to achieve that rank, you have to have some chops, or, you know, as they say, you know, she had to make her bones. She has to have street experience and been in a number of situations, and knows how to deal with them, you know, knows the criminal personality a little bit better. Gina Cattati is a little bit more of a newbie. She knows a lot. She's pretty savvy. But she's young, and she's got a fledgling insurance, detective agency, investigating a lot of insurance claims. She's learning as she's going. You know, she gets a little bit smarter. You know, she's going to get a little brighter with every book, and you know, she stumbles a little bit. And you know, I kind of like that about her, because you know, I mean, how many Jack Reachers do you need who are going to walk into a diner and tell you, you know, where the murderer stood and how much he weighed and the color of his eyes, all, you know, because he, you know, he can intuit it. You know, she's not that intuitive. She's, you know, it's a learning curve for her. And I think that's what makes it fun. She's vulnerable.
And she's more realistic.
She's more realistic. She's more like me.
Now, you said, you know, you take great pains to write realistic police procedure. What about the PIs? Do you need to take liberty with a PI and what the PI can, can't do in real life?
You do have to know the ins and outs of that. And I did, you know, quite a bit of research. I mean, there's a stereotypical conception of what a PI is, you know, back from the old Philip Marlowe days, you know, with a guy sitting behind his desk smoking a cigarette, you know, gulping scotch, and a beautiful, you know, woman walks in and says, you know, my husband's cheating on me. You know, and these detectives will do anything. You know, they'll beat up on people. They'll pay off people. Gina Cattati is not that kind of PI. She only works or takes her leads from actual law enforcement people or people who have been in the law enforcement business, either in the military or the FBI or in intelligence services. She tries to be as cop-like as she can be, again, within the confines of somebody who hasn't gone to the police academy. But she did go to John Jay School of Criminal Justice. So she's, you know, she's got some chops. And, you know, like I said, she's trying to follow the rules. And she's, you know, learning in the process.
Right. And I think, how do you keep the pace going? I mean, I would imagine that I think one of the things to do is to keep challenging your main character. Right, but put her through things and that. And I guess that's kind of how you keep tension on the page.
Absolutely. Well, in this book, it starts off, Gina Marie sort of inherited from her dad an absolutely mint 1963 split-window Corvette Stingray. And she is, you know, she's a gearhead, maybe not to the extent of a Lisa Vito, but she knows her cars, and she's, you know, been around this car since her dad was a young man, and she's helped him clean it and detail it and, you know, and rotate the tires and change carburetors. So she knows her stuff. So she's got this prized Corvette, and she lives in this freestanding house in Brooklyn with a long, narrow driveway. And normally what she has to do is she's got to back 2 clunkers out of the way to get the Corvette up the driveway and into the garage located behind the house. But in the opening chapters of the book, she's in a hurry. She stops home for a moment. gets tied up with his sister for a little bit, and as they're doing what they're doing, the Corvette gets ripped off. Now, this isn't the kind of car that you're going to bring to a chop shop and part it out. This is the kind of car that's going to go to an offshore, you know, collector, a guy who's going to pay major dollars for a very rare car. You know, the car was probably $6,000 new in 1963, but today it's worth $250,000. And she gets some leads, and she finds a mobster, if you will. Not so much a mobster, but, you know, a little gangster type who's got this huge warehouse, and he's, you know, he's having people steal Bentleys and Rolls Royce and Lamborghinis, and he's shipping them to Venezuela and all over the world where he can get prime dollar for it. And, you know, she kind of sort of recovers her Corvette, but runs afoul of this thug. And that's when she starts getting into trouble. He does, you know, he says, I want the Corvette back, or I want the money for it. And if you can't, then I don't want to tell you all the ins and outs or give you spoilers, but she gets in one tough situation after the next. And he keeps throwing things in her way that keep her from, you know, getting even or getting ahead. And, you know, there are a lot of side characters and side plots that kind of, you know, pull her in different directions, and, you know, they're woven around the main plot line. But, I think I do a decent job of keeping the reader glued and moving forward.
Where do you get your side characters, your extra characters? Are they, do you pick up people's habits and attitudes and the way they act in real life? Someone you've seen or noticed, or is it all imagination?
Now, when you say, do I pick up people, are you talking about being a stalker?
Well, that too. I just thought, you know, if you wanted to get into that, elaborate, I mean, by all means, we'll listen. We won't tell anyone.
Yeah, I'm not on broadcast radio. But, you know, I don't think anybody is 100% a person I've seen or met in real life, but more a composite of people that I've met. You know, take somebody from one walk of life and give them a bit of a different personality trait or a different appearance or a different job. And, you know, then the challenge is to keep that person consistent. Because, you know, you don't want to have too many characters, but the characters who are key to the plot, well, they have to stay in character. They have, you know, it's not based on anybody I've actually seen or witnessed. So I have to make sure that they keep talking the same talk and, you know, behaving in the same way that they did early on in the book all the way through. So, yeah, it's sort of a hybrid, you know, hybrid characters is what I would call them.
Well, speaking of that, can you hear your characters? Do you have an inner monologue when you're writing? Is that how you create the dialogue, or do you have another way?
They're always talking to me. Sometimes I wish they'd shut up. I mean, I'm not after 20 years of writing, I'm not a great sleeper. These people are keeping up 2 or 3 hours a night, you know? It's like, you know what? I'll tell your story in the morning. Could you let me go to bed? But yeah, I mean, I can hear my characters. I try to visualize them as best I can. I can definitely hear them and try to picture them in, you know, the situation I've created, you know, which was, you know, sort of, as I said before, I create these situations where Katati is getting into one problem and into another after another. And, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound, every time she takes one step forward, she takes two steps back. I'm creating these scenes or these situations where she's constantly in more and more trouble. And, you know, these characters are floating in and out of her life.
So do these characters tell you what to do? Tell you what you should or shouldn't do? You don't wake up with a shovel in your hand or anything weird, eh?
No, I mean, you know, I haven't gotten to the David Berkowitz stage yet.
Keep working.
No, there are no talking dogs. They don't tell me what to do. I pretty much push them around. Or, you know, I guess I'm sort of, you know, as a director would be in a film, you know, here's a setting. This is what you're going to do. And I give them a shove, go out there and do it. I think I'm still in charge of the characters. It's not a case where the lunatics are running the asylum yet.
Well, so what happens to your character when you stop writing? Like the last series you did, and you're on to a new series now. What happens to your main characters there? Do they just disappear?
No, they get quieter and quieter and quieter until they're not, you know, competing for my attention on a daily basis, or unless I've decided the series isn't working, and then, you know, I silence them altogether. I don't kill them off, but they lose their voices. I've got, after 30 books, I've got, you know, a lot of characters barking at me, and you got to have to moderate their importance in your head.
I was going to say, maybe the old, you know, detective, since she's fighting with the new one, you know, and mm-hmm. the big cat fight here.
There may be a time when they cross paths, you know, we'll see. At this moment, I'm still developing Gina, you know, she needs to become more fleshed out and more of a full-fledged PI. But at some point, she may cross paths with Shalisi. They're both in the New York area. So we'll see. It could be interesting.
Yeah, it could be. Wow. Mm-hmm. So listen, do you like to interact with readers? Do you have social media? Do you have a website? How do you do that?
Yeah, all that stuff. I have a website, presence on, you know, Facebook and Instagram and all those things, and BookBub and Goodreads. And, you know, that part of it's pretty hard, you know, the constant interaction and the marketing of the books, it takes up a lot of time. So I enjoy it, but I have to kind of ice it down to manageable parcels.
And yeah.
You'll find most readers, you know, they'll get in touch with you and they'll say something nice or tell you you're bad.
Oh, my.
Crazy.
Yeah. Well, let's hopefully we get some of those.
I wrote a book some years back, and I went, the initial chapters involve a Gulfstream jet coming in from Israel, landing in New York, and it's going to crash. And I went to all kinds of trouble and research. I was listening to cockpit records and reading transcripts and reading about the aircraft. And of course, I'm not a pilot, but I thought I did a pretty good job. And one of the first reviews somebody posted on Amazon was, "You know nothing about the Gulfstream aircraft." One of the first reviews. So I wrote back and I said, okay, you know, I thought I did a pretty decent job researching this. I said, but you know, if you're a pilot and you want to help me, tell me what I did wrong and I'll go back and I'll edit the book and I'll change it to make it correct. And his response was, nah, who'll know?
Oh, well, there you go. Says it all.
I mean, he had me all freaked out, you know, it's like, oh, you know, he's calling me on the carpet and I worked so hard to get it right. And now he's, you know, challenging me, you know, on the book page, and nah, nobody will never know. Don't worry about it.
So, okay. So what's your website so we can give it up to people and we'll put it up on ours?
It's my full name. It's lawrencekelter.com. No dots, dashes, or hyphens, just my name.
Perfect. And we'll have all that up on the website along with your new book. And of course, the book's called Man Killer, Gina Cotati Paces, Book One. So our guest is the author of that book and many more, Lawrence Kelter. So thank you for being here.
Oh, this was so much fun. Thank you, Alan. And thank you, David.
Thanks, Lawrence.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or show, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or show, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.